Hello, everybody, and welcome indeed to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And today we have a guest from the Los Alamos National Laboratory up in New Mexico. That's the place where the Manhattan Project really got off the ground, so to speak. And his name is Andrew Gaunt, and he's a chemist who studies transuranium elements and their chemistry. So, Andrew, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into what you do, tell us a little bit about how you became a scientist.
So I was born in a small town called Birkenhead in the UK, which is just across the River Mersey from Liverpool. So most Americans will probably know Liverpool from the Beatles, right?
And they recognize your voice straight away.
And hopefully, yeah, I sound like Paul McCartney. And so both my parents came from a working class background, and so I was the first person to actually go to university. So through high school, I kind of didn't really know that science was going to be a career for me. But I was interested in science, and so I decided to try chemistry at university. I really wanted to be a doctor, but I didn't think I was up to it. And had I have known then what I know now, I'm sure I could have been a doctor. And I guess the message there to young people is don't be intimidated by your perception of what scientists and doctors are, because so long as you have a passion, you can probably do it.
So you decided then, in fact, that the sky was the limit once you'd got to about the age of 35 or something.
So, well, right, yes, but I can't relive my younger years again. So anyway, the way the education system is structured in the UK, as you know, is a little bit different. So at the age of 16, we get our what's called GCSEs, and then you decide to specialize in three or four of the subjects that most interest you, and those are called A-levels. So I did chemistry, biology, and mathematics for A-levels, and my chemistry teacher was really inspirational, and so he made me believe that I could, in fact, go to university and try chemistry. So I went to the University of Manchester, and I thought chemistry was really interesting. And during the summers, I had some jobs in factories, and that told me that I really didn't want a real job. So that's why I undertook a PhD, because
that's actually a part of the educational system. Everybody should be made to go and work in a factory.
Right.
Because there's two things for that. One is they realize either they do or they don't like it. But even if they don't like it, they'll have a tremendous respect for the people who do that work.
Absolutely.
Which I think is crucially missing in a lot of modern societies. We sort of don't even give a thought to how things are made.
Right.
And we think, oh, that's just a blue-collar job. They're the most difficult jobs.
Right,
quite
and
often.
It was very high pressure and hard physical labor because obviously
I remember working for the New York laborers in the summer high school and carrying cement bags and stuff like that, and I was making so much money in high school. I said, "Oh, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life." And one of the laborers took me by the neck, threw me against the wall, and said, "You idiot, stay in school."
Cement bags full of union leaders, were they? Anyway, carry on. So you went to the University of Manchester, a very good institution.
So, yeah. And so anyway, I decided that I'd like to do a PhD to stay in education as long as possible. And I guess the reason I got into studying radioactive materials was good timing. So there's a company in the UK called British Nuclear Fuels, and they had decided to invest several million pounds to establish a center for radiochemistry research at the University of Manchester. And so they took on about 10 new PhD students. And it was really just a recognition that nuclear skills had declined and there was an aging workforce. And so they were trying to address that in some way. So that was really how I first got exposed to, pardon the pun, to radioactivity.
Well, tell the audience, I mean, a lot of them know, a lot of them don't. Radioactivity, just radioactivity 101, what are you talking about?
So it's an element which has an unstable nucleus, which emits energy in the form of radioactivity to form a more stable nucleus. And so there's three different types of radioactivity. There's alpha particles, there's beta particles, and then there's gamma rays. Those are the three main ones. Obviously, there's others such as X-rays too. But for the most part, those are the three that we're talking about. And so at Manchester, I primarily worked with depleted uranium. And so that's only considered to be relatively weakly radioactive. It's an alpha particle emitter. And what that means is that the particle which is emitted only travels a few centimeters in air. So you really don't have to worry about getting a radiation dose per se. You have to worry about stopping yourself from inhaling the particles or ingesting them.
So, and we're talking about uranium-238.
So this is, so uranium-238 is what's known as depleted uranium. So it does not have very much of uranium-235.
Which is for the nuclear warheads.
Yes, which is the...
And power stations.
So if it's in a nuclear warhead, it's enriched to a very high percentage of uranium-235. If it's a nuclear fuel, it's a much lower percentage, typically about 5%.
Tell us why uranium-235 at different levels is for different uses. What causes one to be a bomb, the other to be
I should confess that I'm not an expert in nuclear bombs because I'm a foreign national and I don't have a security clearance. but loosely, it's to be able to sustain the chain reaction. So when the uranium nucleus falls apart, it emits neutrons, which then cause other nuclei to fall apart. And so it's a self-sustaining chain reaction. And so you have to have a critical amount of uranium-235 to produce enough neutrons to sustain that reaction. So in a bomb, you want it to happen very quickly and ultimately go bang. Whereas in a nuclear reactor, you want to generate the energy, but you want to be able to control that reaction.
But the other thing that always interested me is that the nuclear warheads have to be reassembled every 10 years or something because the radioactivity causes it to become amorphous and they fall apart.
Right. And so at Los Alamos, what its primary mission is to maintain the stockpile, and primarily it's plutonium processing. So this is taking the plutonium triggers for the nuclear weapons and processing them into new triggers, or in the case of stockpile reduction, trying to actually dispose of the plutonium.
Because we're in a mode of decreasing the stockpile. So when they come in for refurbishing, one gets refurbished, 10 get discarded, or whatever the secret numbers are. But this is a long way from what you were trying to do when you were at Manchester.
So we kind of got off track a long way there. Right. British Nuclear Fuels is a place where they partially recycle spent or used nuclear fuel rods. So when the nuclear fuel goes into a reactor, it can only sustain the fission for typically a couple of years, and then it kind of outlives its usefulness. So you have to remove the fuel rods from the reactor and then put in new fuel. And so what they do in the UK and some other countries, such as France and Japan, is they partially recycle the fuel to remove the plutonium and the uranium and recycle it back into new fuel. So what they wanted was to establish a center at a university which was aimed at understanding the underlying chemical bonding principles behind that chemical processing so that they could better understand the process, help to deal with any problems that might arise, and ultimately design new processes as well. So it was a way to recognize that fundamental academic research has a place in helping the industrial complex to understand what it's doing on a bulk scale.
So what was your first topic? What was your first
paper? So my first topic was actually polyoxometallates, which the simplest way to describe them are metal oxygen clusters of a finite size of tungsten or molybdenum oxides. And the reason this was relevant to nuclear fuel is that when they dissolve up the fuel rods in acid, the molybdenum will essentially polymerize and form these oxide species. And so what we wanted to understand was how the actinides, which are these radioactive elements in the fuel, such as uranium and plutonium, how they might interact with these polyoxometallates and how that might impact the process. So, for example, if you were to see some unexpected precipitation in the process, the industrial plant doesn't understand the chemistry behind that, whereas we can say, okay, here's how uranium interacts with this polyoxometallate, and here's the compound that we think is formed, and here's how to stop it forming. Now, it was a little bit more fundamental than that, but that's the gist of how you can relate academic research to an application.
You're talking about an inorganic compound, or you're talking about when they're doing this, you wind up with moly oxide?
So these are soluble in aqueous, so soluble in water, metal oxygen clusters. So this is inorganic chemistry.
Yeah, but when you're doing this regeneration, so when you wind up with solids at the end, no?
So correct. Although in this particular instance, the aim was to remove the actinides from an aqueous phase into an organic phase via a chemical separation and actually leave behind the molybdenum, which then goes to ultimately be processed into a waste form for disposal. So actually you didn't want to get a solid during this process. You wanted to
– or actually you can use the molybdenum oxide as a good catalyst.
There was also interest in some other groups of switching out the molybdenum for tungsten and actually using tungsten to encapsulate the actinides in a waste form. And so that's one of the other applications.
Okay, so that's what you did as a student. And then you, like a lot of clever Englishmen, you just decided that there were perhaps some new fields to conquer, some new actions, some new discoveries to be made in North America. Uh-huh. So you came to Los Alamos as what we call a postdoctoral student.
Right.
Now, and you've been there about 10, 11 years now.
11 years, yes. Yeah. So actually the way I came to America was during my PhD, I was seconded to Georgetown University for a few months, working in the lab of Michael Pope. And during that time, I did a kind of mini tour of the U.S. National Labs and interviewed. And that was how I stumbled upon Los Alamos. And I discovered that that was the only place that you could really do academic synthetic inorganic chemistry with plutonium. Because at Manchester, we had some radiological facilities, but they couldn't – there was a limit to the hazard that they could cope with, whereas Los Alamos has the infrastructure to kind of do the full Monty, as it were, and handle plutonium, which we couldn't really do on a synthetic scale at Manchester.
Michael Pope was down here many, many years ago.
Really?
He's another Englishman, so he just shows you there's this sort of little mafia of English guys all around the place. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and today our guest is Dr. Andrew Gaunt from the Los Alamos National Laboratory, a specialist on uranium chemistry, plutonium chemistry, chemistry of all those actinides, radioactive actinides. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. Every healthy baby has 23 pairs of chromosomes in each cell. Just one less or one more, and the fetus ends up with a genetic defect.
Children with Down syndrome have an extra copy or trisomy of chromosome 21. Today, most expectant moms are offered genetic testing with some screening for Downs.
Several tests can indicate a problem with the baby. But to be certain, doctors must perform invasive tests which carry the risk of miscarriage. Amniocentesis requires the insertion of a needle into the uterus to extract fluid surrounding the fetus for testing.
Now a new method undergoing trials is not only effective, but risk-free since all it needs is the mother's blood. It analyzes fragments of fetal DNA floating in her blood. These DNA fragments, free of a cell, can be isolated from the plasma portion of the mother's blood.
The test involves sequencing millions of DNA fragments to detect extra copies, and it only takes a few days. When researchers screened about 1,000 expectant moms at 10 weeks, there were fewer false positives compared to other non-invasive tests such as an ultrasound and a hormone-based blood test.
While the test result is not a certainty as you would expect with an amniocentesis, in clinical trials it was 90% accurate in women who are more likely to have a Down's baby.
In addition to Down syndrome, the test can also detect other genetic abnormalities such as Edwards syndrome involving trisomy of chromosome 18 and Patau syndrome, which is caused by trisomy of chromosome 13.
Having this additional non-invasive test available to all expectant moms would offer them greater peace of mind through their pregnancy.
We are Drs. David Neeson and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Andrew Gaunt from the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And Andrew, you were just telling us about some of the things that you did as a student and how you got into the Los Alamos. What are your responsibilities up there now? Are you still doing what you might call academic research? Or
yes, very much so, and that's the attraction of being there, actually, that you can still do that work. So I went there as a postdoc, and essentially I went there to make plutonium compounds to try to understand the chemical bonding. And as we've kind of already alluded to, if you can understand the chemical bonding of plutonium, then that helps you to control and predict its behavior in various processing operations. So, for example, one of the current problems the U.S. has is how to dispose of its spent nuclear fuel. And so currently the policy was a so-called single-pass cycle where you would take the fuel from the reactor, let it cool off for a period of several years, and then it will go for direct geological disposal under
the
ground.
The mountain.
Yeah, under the mountain that never got commissioned. And so the problem is that I think there's about 70,000 metric tons now of spent fuel that's already been generated, and there's no path forward right now. So the idea is that some people have introduced these separations concepts where you can basically reduce the radioactive lifetime of the waste that would have to be stored underground. And so one way to do that is to remove the actinides, which have long half-lives. So plutonium-239 has a half-life of 24,000 years, so it sticks around for a long time.
So in fact, that would have to be something like 250,000 years to get it to be non-dangerous.
Yeah, so the idea is that if you don't remove any of these long-lived radioactive species, then you have to wait 100,000 years or more until it decays back to essentially background level. But if you can essentially recycle the actinides back into new fuel and consume them in the reactor process, then the waste that has to be disposed of underground now only has to stay there for a few hundred years. And in terms of convincing the public that's a good idea and that you can guarantee them it's not going to escape, then that's the idea behind it. But you have to understand the chemistry to do those separations to be able to implement the process.
And I know there's some efforts that we're partially involved in where there might be new uses for the material and the program's called Don't Waste the Waste.
So, correct, yeah.
You know, and perhaps we could find something to do with the stuff that we bury.
So, well, I think, you know, the main hesitation with those things when it involves radioactivity is largely, twofold, an economic one. So some people say, is it cost effective to reprocess this fuel because we don't have any shortage of uranium, at least in this country? For other countries, it might be more of an issue. And then when you start to actually process fuel and separate out plutonium, people get nervous. And so the idea is to design processes where they're proliferation resistant, which means that you don't actually selectively take out the plutonium and purify it. You keep it together with other nasty radioactive elements so that it's not so attractive to actually be sort of siphoned off towards an illicit weapons program.
I mean, these issues are also present in other societies that have the same type of nuclear generation power, right?
Right.
So, I mean, do you get much of an international collaboration with the French, the British?
And in fact, you know, like I said, the UK and the French, with some other countries, already partially reprocessed their fuel, and so they already have a lot of expertise in operating these industrial plants. So there's definitely a lot of collaboration there. And of course, the UK has separated out a large amount of plutonium, and so this proliferation-resistant concern is really in the eye of the beholder, because you can argue that if it's well protected, as it is in the UK, it's really perhaps made out to be a bigger issue than it needs to be, when perhaps the focus should be on how to chemically best encapsulate the waste and focus more on the environmental concerns.
Have you ever been looking back at Oak Ridge, where the whole place was contaminated? I remember visiting there and running into a person, because that's where the stuff was first separated for the bombs in World War II. They had a lot of programs that I thought were pretty fascinating, because they basically had it spread all over the place. Have they cleaned it up?
So with the specifics of Oak Ridge, I'm not sure. I know there was a big cleanup effort at Rocky Flats, where they similarly had a lot of problems with.
In fact, that was a very successful.
Cleanup.
That's the poster child of
right.
Cleanup.
So it shows that it can be done. Right. I guess what I would say to the public is that we've learned from those mistakes, hopefully. And so the idea is that those situations don't occur again. And perhaps what I could do is kind of explain how I operate in my lab, just to tell people some of the safety procedures that we have in place that really means it's very unlikely we would actually, you know, literally take our work home with us in the form of plutonium on our shoes or something. So I work on very, very small scales, tends to be milligrams of plutonium, as opposed to kilograms, which you would get in the weapons. And our lab has a whole array of radiation monitoring equipment. So we have monitors which detect any airborne radioactive alpha emitters, which would instantly alarm if that were ever to happen. So you essentially catch the leak at the source. We have what's called hand and foot monitors that we have to go through every time we exit the lab. And then we have even bigger monitors where they check our whole body before we exit the lab. And we wear things like overshoes over our shoes, and then they have to be disposed of each time. And so really, and we also have dedicated radiological support personnel that go around the lab every week and check to see if any surfaces have become contaminated. So I think when you see it from that perspective, it should kind of reassure people that the chances of us, you know, spreading contamination is fairly slim.
I remember when I first visited the lab and went to the plutonium recycling section, and the director of that group was my escort. And so they'd done all the paperwork, because I was also a British citizen, so they needed paperwork right up the gazoo. Then we finally get to go through the first gate, and my escort, the director, had forgotten his IDs, you know, and they just didn't say, oh, well, boss, go through.
Anywhere, no,
nope. We waited 15 minutes before the whole thing was put to right. So, I mean, it really is a very secure location. Right. But accidents happen. I mean, and
well,
that's the point.
There's always the human error factor. But I suppose what I would say to people is if only people that had concerns could try to work at the lab for a year to see all the procedures that we have to follow, then they would probably go away thinking that we needed less regulation rather than more regulation.
Well, that's absolutely true. I sent some students up there about 12 years ago for some summer experiences, and that was at the time when some student had been there and was asked, is the laser working? And so she looks down the barrel of the laser to see was it on. And, of course, that caused an incredible amount of damage.
That was a big problem. Yeah.
Right. And the laboratories were effectively closed down for that whole summer in terms of getting anything done. Everybody was taking classes in safety.
That's correct. Yeah. So there's no question that safety is the top priority.
Well, I have
a
chemistry question that I want to ask before we get any further. When I was visiting Oak Ridge, there was a lady there that I don't think is there anymore by the name of Brenlyn Faison. Okay. I don't know if you ever heard of her.
No.
But she had discovered, you know, that the uranium, uranyl ions were all in the water and everything because they didn't care about it initially, okay? And she discovered a microorganism that would take the uranyl things and make uranyl phosphate in a vacuole, and they were happy. Mm. And I, having worked on microorganisms cleaning up oil spills, I always thought, why didn't somebody follow these microorganisms that can collect this stuff? If you had a chunk of urinal phosphate in your stomach, you'd be easy to separate from the water because you'd sink.
Right.
So, have you read anything about that?
Just at a very general level, but there are people that have programs up there, which I'm not involved in, looking at bioremediation of uranium. I'm not sure if that's been extended to plutonium, but certainly for uranium, there is a lot of...
I mean, it has to get through the membrane, so there must be some very specific chemistry that allows
right.
it
well,
to
go through. Right. Well, I think a lot of the sort of mechanistic understanding is trying to understand the redox chemistry that happens. So I think there's implied reduction of uranium 6-4 in some cases by the bacteria, and that might go through an intermediate uranium 5 oxidation state, which generally is very unstable. So there's a lot of, you know, basic chemistry to be understood.
But how can they survive with all this radioactivity and be happy?
So, well, I guess that's a similar thing to when you find these organisms growing at these hydrothermal vents under the ocean, right? Evolution has allowed certain organisms to tolerate extreme conditions, and radioactivity is no
different. Yeah, it's fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, some people believe that we have evolved to a certain extent by having background radiation. I mean, you can't drink water anywhere in the world that doesn't have a small amount of uranyl material. So, I mean, all the water you drink anywhere except it comes out of one of these bottles where it's been distilled, I suppose.
It's probably good for you.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point, that in fact, a lot of people have claimed, people who think about this, that in fact a little bit of radiation is help us evolve, and it's not so bad after all.
Right. I think there's some people that you know, believe that. I think there's research that needs to be done to prove that, but we operate on the basis that, you know, the less radiation dose that we're exposed to is always better. However, you have to weight it against things like the radiation dose you get when you take a flight and things like that, and realize that the dose that I get working with these small amounts of plutonium is far less than my background dose, way less. It's very negligible.
But it sounds like you worry about it a little bit, you know?
So it's something where I always say that you have to worry about it to make sure that you don't have an accident. So the last thing you want is for somebody to become comfortable working with it, because that's when you kind of drop your guard and have the accident happen. So you shouldn't be fearful of it, but you should always respect it and never kind of become blasé about handling plutonium.
But all your work is done in what we call glove boxes. I mean, you don't very often do any chemistry in an open environment,
so,
right?
Yeah, so the main hazard with plutonium is inhalation, where you would inhale it and then it would be absorbed into the body and ultimately collect in the bones, and obviously long-term potentially cause cancer. So for that reason, if you work in a glove box, the glove box enclosure protects you from any dispersible plutonium particles. If it's in solution, if it's in water or another liquid, then you don't have to work inside a glove box. You have to work in what's called a ventilated fume hood to make sure that you're not exposed to the fumes. But at that point, you're not likely to inhale the material. So that's kind of how we work.
Let's just go to the point you made right at the beginning, that when this establishment of a nuclear facility in Manchester was put together, it was because the people who had knowledge and activity capacity in the nuclear business were getting older and older and older.
Yeah.
All right. And now it's almost the same thing here now.
It's still a problem in the U.S. And I think both countries are taking steps to try to fix that. But certainly when I went to a Department of Nuclear Energy meeting and I was sitting at the back of the room, all I could see were these white heads in front of me, right?
Yeah.
And there were not very many young people. So I think trying to attract people to study this chemistry is important. And for me, I think it was the intrigue around the radioactivity and the fact that not many people could handle it that kind of attracted me to the chemistry. But I think for some people, they kind of go the other way and get intimidated by it instead.
Well, I mean, my point there is for people out there listening, I mean, this is an area which is, you know, nuclear power is I think, essential for the short term. Is there a good career for people that now say, look,
yes,
I'm going to go and study?
So the point is that even if there's no new build of nuclear reactors, then we already have enough waste to basically sustain many, many people's careers. So that would be the worst case scenario, where we don't have any new nuclear build with Generation 4 reactors. The reality is we probably will. So the job prospects should be very good for anybody coming into the field.
Andrew Gaunt, Los Alamos National Laboratory, ex-Liverpoolian. I guess never an ex-Liverpoolian. Thank you for being here on Science Studio.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Please come back. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another riveting show. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Mentis Rehabilitation will host its second annual Brain Injury Medicine Conference next Saturday. The conference takes place in the Centennial Club on Fort Bliss. More than 200 healthcare professionals from around the region are expected to attend. All proceeds will benefit El Paso's Brain Injury Support Group. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.